The Corpus Hermeticum, translated by G.R.S. Mead. An adult brain audiobook production read to you by Graham Dunlop. An Introduction to the Corpus Hermeticum by John Michael Greer. The 15 tractates of the Corpus Hermeticum, along with the Perfect Sermon or Asclepius, are the foundation documents of the Hermetic tradition. Written by unknown authors in Egypt sometime before the end of the 3rd century CE, they were part of a once substantial literature attributed to the mythic figure of Hermes Trismegistus, a Hellenistic fusion of the Greek god Hermes and the Egyptian god Thoth. This literature came out of the same religious and philosophical ferment that produced Neoplatonism, Christianity, and the diverse collection of teachings usually lumped together under the label Gnosticism. A ferment which had its roots in the impact of Platonic thought on the older traditions of the Hellenized East. There are obvious connections and common themes linking each of these traditions, although each had its own answer to the major questions of the time. The treatises we now call the Corpus Hermeticum were collected into a single volume in Byzantine times, and a copy of this volume survived to come into the hands of Lorenzo de Medici's agents in the 15th century. Marsilio Ficino, the head of the Florentine Academy, was pulled off the task of translating the dialogues of Plato in order to put the Corpus Hermeticum into Latin first. His translation saw print in 1463 and was reprinted at least 22 times over the next century and a half. The treatises divide up into several groups. The first, Chapter 1, the Pomandres, is the account of a revelation given to Hermes Trismegistus by the being Pomandres, or man-shepherd, an expression of the universal mind. The next 8, chapter 2 to 9, the general sermons are short dialogues or lectures discussing various basic points of Hermetic philosophy. There follows the key, chapter 10, a summary of the general sermons, and after this a set of 4 tractates. Mind unto Hermes, About the Common Mind, The Secret Sermon on the Mountain, and The Letter of Hermes to Asclepius, chapter 11 to 14. Touching on the more mystical aspects of Hermeticism, the collection is rounded off by the definitions of Asclepius unto King Ammon, chapter 15, which may be composed of 3 fragments of longer works. The Perfect Sermon. The Perfect Sermon, or Asclepius, which is also included here, reached the Renaissance by a different route. It was translated into Latin in ancient times, reputedly by the same Lucius Apuleius of Madura, whose comic serious masterpiece, The Golden Ass, provides some of the best surviving evidence on the worship of Isis in the Roman world. Augustine of Hippo quotes from the Old Latin translation at length in his City of God, and copies remained in circulation in medieval Europe all the way up to the Renaissance. The original Greek version was lost, although quotations survive in several ancient sources. The Perfect Sermon is substantially longer than any other surviving work of ancient Hermetic philosophy. It covers topics which also occur in the Corpus Hermeticum, but touches on several other issues as well. Among them, magical processes for the manufacture of gods, and a long and gloomy prophecy of the decline of Hermetic wisdom and the end of the world. The significance of the Hermetic writings. The Corpus Hermeticum landed like a well-aimed bomb amid the philosophical systems of late medieval Europe. Quotations from the Hermetic literature and the Church Fathers, who were never shy of leaning on pagan sources to prove a point, accepted a traditional chronology which dated Hermes Trismegistus as a historical figure to the time of Moses. As a result, the Hermetic tractates' borrowings from Jewish scripture and Platonic philosophy were seen in the Renaissance as evidence that the Corpus Hermeticum had anticipated and influenced both. The Hermetic philosophy was seen as a primordial wisdom tradition, identified with the wisdom of the Egyptians mentioned in Exodus and lauded in Platonic dialogues such as the Timaeus. It thus served as a useful club in the hands of intellectual rebels who sought to break the stranglehold of Aristotelian scholasticism on the universities at this time. It also provided one of the most important weapons to another major rebellion of the age, the attempt to reestablish magic as a socially acceptable spiritual path in the Christian West. Another body of literature attributed to Hermes Trismegistus was made up of astrological, alchemical, and magical texts. If, as the scholars of the Renaissance believed, Hermes was a historical person who had written all these things, and if church fathers had quoted his philosophical works with approval, and if those same works could be shown to be wholly in keeping with some definitions of Christianity, then the whole structure of magical hermeticism could be given a second-hand legitimacy in a Christian context. This didn't work, of course. The radical redefinition of Western Christianity that took place in the Reformation and Counter-Reformation hardened doctrinal barriers to the point that people were being burned in the 16th century for practices that were considered evidences of devoutness in the 14th. The attempt, though, made the language and concepts of the Hermetic tractates central to much of post-medieval magic in the West. The translation. The translation of the Corpus Hermeticum and Perfect Sermon given here is that of G.R.S. Meade, 1863-1933, originally published as Volume 2 of his Thrice Greatest Hermes, London, 1906. Meade was a close associate of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky, the founder and moving spirit of the Theosophical Society, and most of his considerable scholarly output was brought out under Theosophical auspices. The result, predictably, was that most of that output has effectively been blacklisted in academic circles ever since. This is unfortunate, for Meade's translations of the Hermetic literature were, until quite recently, the best available in English. They are still the best in the public domain, thus their use here. The Everard translation of 1650, which is still in print, reflects the state of scholarship at the time it was made, which is only a criticism because a few things have been learned since then. The Walter Scott translation, despite the cover blurb on the recent Shambhala reprint. This is not the Sir Walter Scott of Ivanhoe fame. While more recent than Meade's, is a product of the new criticism of the first half of this century, and garbles the text severely. Scholars of Hermeticism of the caliber of Dame Frances Yates have labeled the Scott translation worthless. By contrast, a comparison of Meade's version to the excellent modern translation by Brian Copenhaver, or to the translations of Chapter 1, Pomandres, and 7, The Greatest Ill Among Men is Ignorance of God, given in Bentley Layton's The Gnostic Scriptures, shows Meade as a capable translator with a usually solid grasp of the meaning of these sometimes obscure texts. There is admittedly one problem with Meade's translation. The aesthetics of the English text. Meade hoped, as he mentioned at the beginning of Thrice Greatest Hermes, to render these beautiful theosophic treatises into an English that might perhaps be thought in some small way worthy of the Greek originals. Unfortunately for this ambition, he was writing at a time when the last remnants of the florid and pompous Victorian style were fighting it out with the more straightforward colloquial prose that became the style of the new century. Caught in this tangle, like so many writers of the time, Meade wanted to write in the grand style, but apparently didn't know how. The result is a sometimes bizarre mishmash in which turn-of-the-century slang stands cheek by jowl with overblown phrases in King James Bible diction, and in which mishandled archaicisms, inverted word order, and poetic contractions render the text less than graceful, and occasionally less than readable. Seen from a late 20th century sensibility, the result verges on unintentional self-parody in places. For example, where Meade uses the Scots contraction ta'en for taken, apparently for sheer poetic color, calling up an image of Hermes Trismegistus in kilt and sporran. The poetic word order is probably the most serious barrier to readability. It's a good rule, whenever the translation seems to descend into gibberish, to try shuffling the words of the sentence in question. It may also be worth noting that Mead consistently uses "for that" in place of "because" and "ought" in place of "any," and leaves out the word "the" more or less at random. Pomandres, the Shepherd of Men. Notes on the text. This is the most famous of the Hermetic documents, a revelation account describing a vision of the creation of the universe and the nature and fate of humanity. Authors from the Renaissance onward have been struck by the way in which its creation myth seems partly inspired by Genesis, partly reacting against it. The fall has here become the descent of the primal man through the spheres of the planets to the world of nature, a descent caused not by disobedience but by love, and done with the blessing of God. The seven rulers of fate discussed in sections 9, 14, and 25 are the archons of the seven planets, which also appear in Plato's Timaeus and in a number of the ancient writings usually lumped together as Gnostic. Their role here is an oddly ambivalent one, powers of harmony who are nonetheless the sources of humanity's tendencies to evil. It chanced once on a time my mind was meditating on the things that are. My thought was raised to a great height, the senses of my body being held back, just as men who are weighed down with sleep after a fill of food or from fatigue of body. Methought a being, more than vast, in size beyond all bounds, called out my name, and saith, "What wouldst thou hear and see? And what hast thou in mind to learn and know?" And I do say, "Who art thou?" He saith, "I am man-shepherd, Pomandres, mind of all masterhood. I know what thou desirest, and I am with thee everywhere." And I reply, "I long to learn the things that are, and comprehend their nature, and know God. This is," I said, "what I desire to hear." He answered back to me, "Hold in thy mind all thou wouldst know, and I will teach thee." Even with these words, his aspect changed, and straightway, in the twinkling of an eye, all things were open to me, and I see a vision limitless, all things turned into light. Sweet, joyous light, and I became transported as I gazed. But in a little while darkness came settling down on part of it, awesome and gloomy, coiling in sinuous folds, so that methought it like unto a snake. And then the darkness changed into some sort of a moist nature, tossed about beyond all power of words, belching out smoke as from a fire, and groaning forth a wailing sound that beggars all description. And after that an outcry inarticulate came forth from it, as though it were a voice of fire. Thereon, out of the light, a holy word, Logos, descended on that nature, and upwards to the height from the moist nature leaped forth pure fire. Light was it, swift and active too. The air, too, being light, followed after the fire, from out of the earth and water rising up to fire so that it seemed to hang therefrom. But earth and water stayed so mingled with each other that earth from water no one could discern. Yet were they moved to hear by reason of the spirit word Logos pervading them. Then saith to me, man-shepherd,
"Didst understand this vision, what it means?"
"Nay. That shall I know," said I.
"That light,"
he said,
"am I, thy God, mind, prior to moist nature which appeared from darkness. The light word, Logos, that appeared from mind is Son of God."
"What then?" say I.
"Know that what sees in thee and hears is the Lord's word, Logos, but mind is Father God. Not separate are they, the one from other, just in their union, rather, is it life consists."
"Thanks be to thee," I said.
"So understand the light,"
he answered,
"and make friends with it."
And speaking thus, he gazed for long into my eyes, so that I trembled at the look of him. But when he raised his head, I see in mind the light. But now in powers no man could number, and cosmos grown beyond all bounds, and that the fire was compassed round about by a most mighty power, and now subdued had come unto a stand. And when I saw these things, I understood by reason of man-shepherd's word logos. But as I was in great astonishment, he saith to me again,
Thou didst behold in mind the archetypal form whose being is before beginning without end.
Thus spake to me man-shepherd. And I say, Whence then have nature's elements their being? To this he answer gives,
From will of God. Nature received the word logos, and gazing upon the cosmos beautiful did copy it, making herself into a cosmos by means of her own elements and by the births of souls. And God, the mind, being male and female both, as light and life subsisting, brought forth another mind to give things form, who, God as he was of fire and spirit, formed seven rulers who enclose the cosmos that the sense perceives. Men call their ruling fate. Straightway from out the downward elements, God's reason, logos, leaped up to nature's pure formation, and was at one with the formative mind, for it was coessential with it, and nature's downward elements were thus left reasonless, so as to be pure matter. Then the formative mind, at one with reason, he who surrounds the spheres and spins them with his whirl, set turning his formations, and let them turn from a beginning boundless unto an endless end. For that the circulation of these spheres begins where it doth end, as mind doth will. And from the downward elements nature brought forth lives reasonless, for he did not extend the reason logos to them. The air brought forth things winged, the water things that swim, and earth and water one from another parted, as mind willed. And from her bosom earth produced what lives she had, four-footed things and reptiles, beasts wild and tame. But all-father mind, being life and light, did bring forth man coequal to himself, with whom he fell in love, as being his own child. For he was beautiful beyond compare, the image of his sire. In very truth, God fell in love with his own form, and on him did bestow all of his own formations. And when he gazed upon what the informer had created in the Father, man too wished to inform. And so assent was given him by the Father, changing his state to the formative sphere, in that he was to have his whole authority. He gazed upon his brother's creatures. They fell in love with him, and gave him each a share of his own ordering. And after that he had well learned their essence and had become a sharer in their nature. He had a mind to break right through the boundary of their spheres and to subdue the might of that which pressed upon the fire. So he who hath the whole authority over all the mortals in the cosmos and over its lives irrational, bent his face downwards through the harmony, breaking right through its strength and showed to downward nature God's fair form. And when she saw that form of beauty which can never satiate, and him who now possessed himself within each single energy of all seven rulers, as well as God's own form, she smiled with love. For it was as though she had seen the image of man's fairest form upon her water, his shadow on her earth. He in turn beholding the form like to himself existing in her water, loved it and willed to live in it. And with the will came act, and so he vivified the form devoid of reason. And nature took the object of her love and wound herself completely around him, and they were intermingled, for they were lovers. And this is why beyond all creatures on the earth man is twofold, mortal because of body, but because of the essential man immortal. Though deathless and possessed of sway over all, yet doth he suffer as a mortal doth, subject to fate? Thus, above all the harmony, within the harmony he hath become a slave, though male, female, as from a father, male, female, and though he is sleepless from a sleepless sire, yet he is overcome by sleep.
Thereon, I say, teach on. O mind of me, for I myself as well am amorous of the word, logos. The shepherd said,
this is the mystery kept hid until this day.
Nature embraced by man brought forth a wonder, oh so wonderful. For as he had the nature of the concord of the seven, who, as I said to thee, were made of fire and spirit, nature delayed not, but immediately brought forth seven men, in correspondence with the natures of the seven, male, female, and moving in the air. Thereon, I said, O shepherd, for now I am filled with great desire and long to hear, and do not run off. The shepherd said,
keep silence, for not as yet have I unrolled for thee the first discourse, logoi.
Lo, I am still, I said. In such wise, then, as I have said, the generation of these seven came to pass. Earth was as woman, her water filled with longing, ripeness she took from fire, spirit from ether. Nature thus brought forth frames to suit the form of man. And man from light and life changed into soul and mind, from life to soul, from light to mind. And thus continued all the sense world's parts until the period of their end and new beginnings. Now listen to the rest of the discourse, logos, which thou dost long to hear. The period being ended, the bond that bound them was all loosened by God's will. For all the animals being male-female at the same time with man were loosed apart, soon became partly male, some in like fashion, partly female, and straightway God spake by his holy word, logos.
Increase ye in increasing, and multiply in multitude, ye creatures and creations all, and man that hath mind in him, let him learn to know that he himself is deathless, and that the cause of death is love, though love is all.
When he said this, his forethought did by means of fate and harmony affect their couplings and their generations founded. And so all things were multiplied according to their kind. And he who thus hath learned to know himself hath reached that good which doth transcend abundance. But he who through a love that leads astray expends his love upon his body. He stays in darkness wandering and suffering through his senses things of death. What is the so great fault, said I, the ignorant commit, that they should be deprived of deathlessness?
Thou seemest,
he said,
O thou, not to have given heed to what thou heardest. Did I not bid thee think?
Yeah, do I think, and I remember, and therefore give thee thanks.
If thou didst think thereon,
said he,
tell me, why do thy merit death who are in death?
It is because the gloomy darkness is the root and base of the material frame. From it came the moist nature. From this the body in the sense world was composed, and from this the body, death, doth the water drain. Right was thy thought, O thou, but how doth he who knows himself go unto him, as God's word, logos, hath declared? And I reply, the Father of the universals doth consist of light and life. From him man was born.
Thou sayest well, thus speaking. Light and life is Father God, and from him man was born. If then thou learnest that thou art thyself of life and light, and that thou happenest to be out of them, thou shalt return again to life.
Thus did man's shepherd speak. But tell me further, mind of me, I cried, how shall I come to life again? For God doth say, the man who hath mind in him, let him learn to know that he himself is deathless. Have not all men then mind?
Thou sayest well, O thou, thus speaking, I mind myself am present with holy men and good, the pure and merciful, men who live piously. To such my presence doth become an aid, and straightway they gain gnosis of all things, and win the Father's love by their pure lives, and give him thanks, invoking on him blessings, and chanting hymns, intent on him with ardent love. And ere they give up the body into its proper death, they turn them with disgust from its sensations,
from knowledge of what things they operate. Nay, it is I, the mind, that will not let the operations which befall the body work to their natural end. For being doorkeeper, I will close up all the entrances and cut the mental actions off which base and evil energies induce. But to the mindless ones, the wicked and depraved, the envious and covetous, and those who murder, do, and love impiety, I am far off, yielding my place to the avenging daemon, who, sharpening the fire, tormenteth him and addeth fire to fire upon him, and rusheth upon him through his senses, thus rendering him readier for transgressions of the law, so that he mates with greater torment. Nor doth he ever cease to have desire for appetites inordinate, insatiately striving in the dark.
Well hast thou taught me all as I desired, O mind. And now pray, tell me further of the nature of the way above as now it is for me. To this man-shepherd said,
When the material body is to be dissolved, first thou surrenderest the body by itself unto the work of change. And thus the form thou hadst doth vanish, and thou surrenderest thy way of life, void of its energy, unto the daemon. The body's senses next pass back into their sources, becoming separate and resurrect as energies, and passion and desire withdraw unto that nature which is void of reason. And thus it is that man doth speed his way thereafter upwards through the harmony. To the first zone he gives the energy of growth and waning. Unto the second zone, device of evils, now de-energized. Unto the third, the guile of the desires de-energized. Unto the fourth, the domineering arrogance, also de-energized. Unto the fifth, unholy daring and the rashness of audacity, de-energized. Unto the sixth, striving for wealth by evil means, deprived of its aggrandizement, and to the seventh zone, ensnaring falsehood, de-energized. And then, with all the energizings of the harmony stripped from him, clothed in his proper power, he cometh to that nature which belongs unto the eighth, and there with those that are hymneth the Father. They who are there welcome his coming there with joy. And he, made like to them that sojourn there, doth further hear that the powers who are above the nature that belongs into the eighth, singing their songs of praise to God in language of their own. And then they, in a band, go to the Father's home. Of their own selves they make surrender of themselves to powers, and thus, becoming powers, they are in God. This the good end for those who have gained gnosis, to be made one with God. Why shouldst thou then delay? Must it not be, since thou hast all received, that thou shouldst to the worthy point the way, in order that through thee the race of mortal kind may by thee God be saved?
This, when he had said, man-shepherd mingled with the powers, but I, with thanks and blessings unto the Father of the universal powers, was freed, full of the power he had poured into me, and full of what he had taught me of the nature of the all and of the loftiest vision. And I began to preach unto men the beauty of devotion and of gnosis. O ye people, earth-born folk, ye who given themselves to drunkenness and sleep and ignorance of God, be sober now. Cease from your surfeit, cease to be glamoured by irrational sleep. And when they heard, they came with one accord, whereon I say, Ye earth-born folk, why have ye given yourselves up to death, while yet ye have the power of sharing deathlessness? Repent, O ye who walk with error arm in arm, and make of ignorance the sharer of your board. Get ye out from light of darkness, and take your part in deathlessness, forsake destruction. And some of them with jests upon their lips departed from me, abandoning themselves unto the way of death. Others entreated to be taught, casting themselves before my feet. But I made them arise, and I became a leader of the race towards home, teaching the words Logi, how and in what way they shall be saved. I sowed in them the words, Logi, of wisdom, of deathless water were they given to drink. And when even was come, and all sun's beams began to set, I bade them all give thanks to God. And when they had brought to an end the giving of their thanks, each man returned to his own resting place. But I recorded in my heart man's shepherd's benefaction, and with my every hope fulfilled more than rejoiced. For body's sleep became the soul's awakening and closing of the eyes, true vision pregnant with good my silence, and the utterance of my words, logos, begetting of good things. All this befell me from my mind that is man's shepherd, word logos of all masterhood, by whom, being God inspired, I came unto the plane of truth. Wherefore, with all my soul and strength, thanksgiving give I unto Father God. Holy art thou, O God, the universal's Father. Holy art thou, O God, whose will perfects itself by means of its own powers. Holy art thou, O God, who willeth to be known and art known by thine own. Holy art thou, who didst by word, logos, make to consist the things that are. Holy art thou, of whom all nature hath been made an image. Holy art thou, whose form nature hath never made. Holy art thou, more powerful than all power. Holy art thou, transcending all preeminence. Holy thou art, thou better than all praise. Accept my reason's offerings pure from soul and heart, for I stretched up to thee, O thou unutterable, unspeakable, whose name naught but the silence can express. Give ear to me, who pray that I may never of gnosis fail, gnosis, which is our common being's nature, and fill me with thy power, and with this grace of thine, that I may give the light to those in ignorance of thy race, my brethren and thy sons. For this cause I believe, and I bear witness. I go to life and light. Blessed art thou, O Father. Thy man would be holy as thou art holy, even as thou gave him thy full authority to be. To Asclepius. Notes on the text. This dialogue sets forth the difference between the physical and metaphysical worlds in the context of Greek natural philosophy. Some of the language is fairly technical. The errant spheres of sections 6 and 7 are the celestial spheres carrying the planets, while the inherent sphere is that of the fixed stars. It is useful to keep in mind also that air and spirit are interchangeable concepts in Greek thought, and that the concept of the good has a range of implications which don't come across in the English word. One is that the good of any being in Greek thought was also that being's necessary goal. Hermes. Hermes. All that is moved, Asclepius, is it not moved in something and by something? Asclepius.
Assuredly.
Hermes. And must not that in which it's moved be greater than the moved? Asclepius.
It must.
Mover, again, has greater power than moved?
It has, of course.
The nature, furthermore, of that in which it's moved must be quite other from the nature of the moved?
It must completely.
Is not, again, this cosmos vast, so vast, that then it there exists no body greater?
Assuredly.
And massive, too, for it is crammed with multitudes of other mighty frames, nay, rather all the other bodies that there are?
It is.
And yet the cosmos is a body?
It is a body.
And one that's moved?
Assuredly.
Of what size, then, must be the space in which it's moved? And of what kind must be the nature of that space? Must it not be far vaster than the cosmos in order that it may be able to find room for its continued course, so that the moved may not be cramped for want of room and lose its motion?
Something, thrice greatest one, it needs must be immensely vast.
And of what nature? Must it not be, Asclepius, of just the contrary, and is not contrary to body bodiless?
Agreed.
Space, then, is bodiless, but bodiless must either be some godlike thing or God himself. And by some godlike thing, I mean no more the generable, i.e. that which is generated, but the ingenerable. If then space be some godlike thing, it is substantial, but if 'tis God himself, it transcends substance. But it is to be thought of otherwise than God, and in this way, God is first thinkable or intelligible for us, not for himself, for that the thing that's thought doth fall beneath the thinker's sense. God then cannot be thinkable unto himself, in that he's thought of by himself as being nothing else but what he thinks. But he is something else for us, and so he's thought of by us. If space is, therefore, to be thought, it should not then be thought as God but space. If God is also to be thought, he should not be conceived as space but as energy that can contain all space. Further, all that is moved not in the moved but in the stable, and that which moves another is of course stationary, for 'tis impossible that it should move with it.
How is it then that things down here, thrice greatest one, are moved with those that are already moved? For thou hast said the errant spheres were moved by the inherent one.
This is not, O Asclepius, a moving with but one against. They are not moved with one another, but one against the other. It is this contrariety which turneth the resistance of their motion into rest, for that resistance is the rest of motion. Hence, too, the errant spheres, being moved contrarily to the inerrant one, are moved by one another by mutual contrariety, and also by the stable one through contrariety itself. And this can otherwise not be. The bears up there, i.e. Ursa Major and Minor, which neither set nor rise, thinkest thou they rest or move?
They move, thrice greatest one.
And what their motion, my Asclepius?
Motion that turns forever round the same.
But revolution, motion round the same, is fixed by rest, for round the same doth stop beyond same. Beyond same, then, being stopped, if it be steadied in round same. The contrary stands firm, being rendered ever stable by its contrariety. Of this I'll give thee here on earth an instance, which the eye can see. Regard the animals down here. A man, for instance, swimming. The water moves, yet the resistance of his hands and feet give him stability, so that he is not borne along with it, nor sunk thereby.
Thou hast, thrice greatest one, adduced a most clear instance.
All motion, then, is caused in station and by station. The motion, therefore, of the cosmos and of every other hylic, i.e. material greater than animal, will not be caused by things exterior to the cosmos, but by things interior, outward to the exterior, such things as soul, or spirit, or some such other thing incorporeal. 'Tis not the body that doth move the living thing in it, nay, not even the whole body of the universe, a lesser body, even though there be no life in it.
What meanest thou by this, thrice greatest one? Is it not bodies, then, that move the stock and stone and all the other things inanimate?
By no means, O Asclepius. The something in the body, the that which moves the thing inanimate, that surely is not a body, for that it moves the two of them, both body of the lifter and the lifted, so that a thing that's lifeless will not move a lifeless thing. That which doth move another thing is animate, but that it is the mover. Thou seest then how heavy laden is the soul, for it alone doth lift two bodies. That things moreover moved are moved in something as well as moved by something is clear.
Yeah, O thrice greatest one, things moved must needs be moved in something void.
Thou sayest well, O my Asclepius. For naught of things that are is void. Alone the is-not is void and stranger to subsistence, for that which is subsistence can never change to void.
Are there then, O thrice greatest one, no such things as an empty cask, for instance, and an empty jar, a cup and vat, and other things like unto them?
Alack, Asclepius, for thy far wandering from the truth. thinkest thou that things most full and most replete are void?
How meanest thou, thrice greatest one?
Is not air a body?
It is.
And doth this body not pervade all things, and so pervading fill them? And body? Doth body not consist from blending of the four elements? Full, then, of air are all thou callest void, and if of air, then of the four. Further, of this the converse follows, that all thou callest full or void of air, for that they have their space filled out with other bodies, and therefore are not able to receive the air therein. These, then, which thou dost say are void, they should be hollow-named, not void. For they not only are, but they are full of air and spirit.
Thy argument, Logos, thrice greatest one, is not to be gainsaid. Air is a body. Further, it is a body which doth pervade all things, and so pervading fill them. What are we, then, to call that space in which the all doth move?
The bodiless, Asclepius?
What, then, is bodiless?
'Tis mind and reason, Logos, whole out of whole, all self-embracing, free from all body, from all error free, unsensible to body and untouchable, self-stayed in self, containing all, preserving those that are, whose rays, to use a likeness, are good, truth, light beyond light, the archetype of soul.
What then is God?
Not any of these is he, for he is that that causeth them to be, both all and each and everything of all that are. Nor hath he left a thing besides that is not. But they are all from things that are and not from things that are not. For that the things that are not have naturally no power of being anything, but naturally have the power of the inability to be. And conversely, the things that are have not the power of sometime not being.
What sayest thou ever then God is?
God, therefore, is not mind, but cause that the mind is. God is not spirit, but God that spirit is. God is not light, but cause that the light is. Hence one should honor God with these two names, the good and father, names which pertain to him alone and no one else. For no one of the other so-called gods, no one of men or daemons, can be in any measure good but God alone, and he is good alone and nothing else. The rest of things are separable, all from the good's nature, for all the rest are soul and body, which have no place that can contain the good. For that as mighty is the greatness of the good as is the being of all things that are, both bodies and things bodiless, things sensible and intelligible things. Call thou not, therefore, aught else good, for thou wouldst immanus be, nor anything at all at any time call God but good alone, for so thou wouldst again be impious. Though then the good is spoken of by all, it is not understood by all what thing it is. Not only then is God not understood by all, but both unto the gods and some of the men they out of ignorance do give the name of good, though they can never either be or become good. For they are very different from God. While good can never be distinguished from him, for that God is the same as good. The rest of the immortal ones are nonetheless honored with the name of God and spoken of as gods. But God is good not out of courtesy but out of nature, for that God's nature and the good is one. One as the kind of both from which all other kinds proceed. The good is he who gives all things and not receives. God then doth give all things and receive not. God then is good and good is God. The other name of God is Father, again because he is the that which maketh all. The part of Father is to make. Wherefore child-making is a very great and most pious thing in life for them who think aright, and to leave life on earth without a child a very great misfortune and impiety. And he who hath no child is punished by the daemons after death. And this is the punishment, that the man's soul who hath no child shall be condemned unto a body, with neither man's nor woman's nature, a thing accursed beneath the sun. Wherefore, Asclepius, let not your sympathies be with the man who hath no child, but rather pity his mishap, knowing what punishment abides for him. Let all that has been said, then, be to thee, Asclepius, an introduction to the gnosis of the nature of all things. The Sacred Sermon. Notes on the text. This brief, and possibly somewhat garbled, text recounts the creation and nature of the world in terms much like those of the Pomandres. The major theme is the renewal of all things in a cyclic universe, with the seven planetary rulers again playing a major role. The glory of all things is God, Godhead and godly nature, source of the things that are as God, who is both mind and nature. Yeah, matter, the wisdom that reveals all things. Source, too, is Godhead. Yeah, nature, energy, necessity, and end, and making new again. Darkness that knew no bounds was in abyss, and water, too, and subtle breath intelligent. These were by power of God in chaos. Then holy light arose, and there collected neath dry space, literally, sand, from out moist essence elements, and all the gods do separate things out from fecund nature. All things being undefined and yet unwrought, the light things were assigned unto the height, the heavy ones had their foundations laid down underneath the moist part of dry space. The universal things being bounded off by fire and hanged in breath to keep them up. And heaven was seen in the seven circles. Its gods were visible in forms of stars with all their signs, while nature and her members made articulate together with the gods in her. And heaven's periphery revolved in cyclic course borne on by breath of God. And every god by his own proper power brought forth what was appointed him. Thus there arose four-footed beasts and creeping things, and those that in the water dwell, and things with wings, and everything that beareth seed and grass, and shoot of every flower, all having in themselves seed of again becoming. And they selected out the births of men for gnosis of the works of God and attestation of the energy of nature, the multitude of men for lordship over all beneath the heaven and gnosis of its blessings, that they might increase in increasing and multiply in multitude, and every soul enfleshed by revolution of the cyclic gods. For observation of the marvels of heaven and heaven's God's revolution, and of the works of God and energy of nature, for tokens of its blessings, for gnosis of the power of God, that they might know the fates that follow God and evil deeds, and learn the cunning work of all good arts. Thus there begins their living and their growing wise according to the fate appointed by the revolution of the cyclic gods and their decreasing for this end. And there shall be memorials mighty of their handiworks upon the earth, leaving dim trace behind when cycles are renewed. For every birth of flesh and soul, and of the fruit of seed, and every handiwork, though it decay, shall of necessity renew itself, both by the renovation of the gods and by the turning round of nature's rhythmic wheel. For that whereas the Godhead is nature's ever-making new again, the cosmic mixture, nature herself, is also co-established in that Godhead. Thank you for listening to this sample. To continue listening to this book and for access to all of our other full audiobooks, please subscribe for $7.77 per month. Go to adultbrain.ca or follow the link in the show notes. This will be a completely separate podcast with a new RSS feed and will have all the titles from this feed as well. Thank you for your help and support in bringing rare and forgotten books to audio for the world.